just to make sure, because... Did I lose you, Representative Maurer?
Yes.
Okay, let's try. I think I have... I'm going to hit flash again. See, I just keep getting dial tone.
You should see the dial tone.
Okay, now we have... So we had to hit flash.
Okay, everybody's together? Do we have Representative Richardson and Representative Maurer on the phone?
Hey, Richardson's here. Representative Maurer's here.
Excellent.
Good. Then we have a full house and an empty chair. I do want everybody to notice Representative Gelster's beautiful orange sweater.
That's great.
So you have special permission to wear that. I want to make sure it's noted.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Is that an OIC sweater?
You know, it is a Beavers meet, so go Beavs.
Good. Okay.
She never misses a moment.
I've learned.
You're going to make me an Ultra Duck fan.
Senator Morissette here. Am I missing? Senator Morissette. Okay. We were going to move Senate Bill 362A to a hearing at Senator Morissette's schedule, which we thought was 3 o'clock, but... As soon as he shows up, we will move that up. Madam Minister, what is it we're not doing today?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we are not doing today is House Bill 2524, which got carried over from the subcommittee yesterday to Tuesday. That is the infection bill, the reporting bill. Also, that's all that I know of at this time.
That we're not doing for sure.
That we totally carried over.
Time may take us out from other things, because I have promised the committee members on Friday afternoon we would be done by 5 o'clock. So we need to move expeditiously. Senator Morissette is with us now. And at this time, I will open a work session on Senate Bill.
Public hearing.
I'm sorry, a public hearing on Senate Bill 362. She's pulling the strings and the mouth is going, but the ventriloquy is not working very well tonight. Okay. Senator Morissette, welcome. You've done an extraordinary job on this, and we've heard about it in the joint hearing we had on it, on one of our bills. So I think we can be...
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Committee. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Okay, Senate Bill 362 essentially opens the prescription drug program to the underinsured. The program currently is open to 54 and older, 185% of poverty. Actually, and it's open to the uninsured. Measure 44 opened it to the uninsured. This would expand it to those people who do have high copays, who don't have adequate insurance, who find themselves not being able to afford prescription drugs, even though they do have insurance, and that's basically what it does.
Representative Richardson, Representative Maurer, can you hear all right?
Representative Maurer, it's a little hard to hear him. If he maybe move the mic a little closer.
Okay.
Okay, great. And
how's that,
Dennis?
That's the same. I struggle here, but it would be a little bit better if there's your volume.
Okay. Thank you. So to repeat that, the bill basically opens the bulk purchasing pool to those people who are underinsured. We had testimony when we had our joint hearing, for instance, from Chris Davies of SAFE, and he supported the bill because that was allowed people who are in that program to buy their prescription drugs at a more competitive rate. And I also view this as a competitive bill because it forces the insurance companies to have more reasonable rates. The bill expands our drug purchasing pool. Currently, we have an agreement with the state of Washington. They have combined their numbers with our numbers, and the pool is growing. There is no cost to the consumer currently. Anyone can get a free card that they can use interchangeably with with their Medicare D card right now. Seniors are able to use their Medicare D card with their private insurance company. We did get that waiver from CMS at the beginning of the year, which allows them to use the card during the donut hole when drugs are very expensive and they have to build up their expense in the meantime, and this allows them to do that. So I think it's a good bill, and it does address one of the biggest cost drivers in the medical field, which is prescription drugs. It's not the perfect answer, but it's part of the solution, and it's a move in the right direction, and I think it's a good bill, and I appreciate your being here, and I urge you to support the bill.
And you have proposed an amendment, is that correct, which I think are the A3 amendments?
Yes. The A3 amendment is basically an emergency clause which was overlooked, and the emergency clause would allow the bill to go into effect when the governor signs the bill.
Thank you, Senator Morgan. Any questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Will you hang in a minute?
Yes, I'll.
We'll have Mr. Gardner, who's also signed up, join us. Yes, sir.
I couldn't understand what the amendment is.
The A3 amendments are simply to put an emergency clause on the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, let me just correct the chair.
And, Mr. Chair, just for the record, Senate Bill 362 left the Senate floor with 21 ayes and 5 no votes.
And it's sort of my intention to move this today, meaning that we've sort of heard it before.
Yes. And just as while we're waiting, as a footnote, you will recall we did have a joint meeting with the Senate Health Committee. We heard our bill, 2213, which you received a lot of information on, as well as the Senate Committee heard the information on their bill, 362.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing here today on behalf of PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. We do reluctantly offer our opposition to this bill for the reasons that are stated in my written testimony. I think you've probably heard those already from the prior hearing, but one issue that I do want to raise for your attention, and knowing full well that that this is a change to the bill that probably is not going to find favor with this committee, it nonetheless, I think, is an issue that at some point in some manner should be addressed. And the issue, quite simply, is the issue of cost comparison. The chart that I have passed out to you, which illustrates what I believe is the need for something like the -2 amendments that are also being passed out to you, basically compares price of various outlets, various retail outlets for two key generic drugs, which are very frequently prescribed drugs and are representative of the kinds of drugs for which the Oregon Prescription Drug Plan has been able to negotiate discounts essentially at the retail level. And what this chart illustrates is that the price variation pharmacy to pharmacy frequently greatly exceeds the discount amount that the program has been able to achieve. And so the essence of that, the lesson that I take from that is that it it is very important as a practical matter for customers, particularly low-income customers, to have an easily accessible means of price shopping for frequently prescribed generic drugs, comparing the price, for instance, at Costco to the price at Rite Aid to the price at Walmart. And what you see in that chart is that, for instance, the variation between the Rite Aid price and the Walmart and Target prices for Atenolol, which is a hypertension medication, is roughly 200%, which is significantly in excess of what the program estimates that it is able to achieve of 60% savings. The difference is even more dramatic with regard to the second representative drug, generic lisinopril, where there's a 475% difference. Now, I recognize that, that probably a majority of the committee does not wish to insert this amendment in this bill. It was a piece of legislation two sessions ago that then-Representative Bates championed and which we supported, and I simply offer this to suggest that it would be valuable through one means or another, public sector or private sector, and perhaps a public interest group that might take this issue under their wing, for the consumer to have in a handy manner this kind of price comparison.
Mr. Gardner, thank you very much. Other questions? I must say that I do have. Can I ask the folks in the back of the room to move out of the room, please? I have some sympathy with this. I think the problem of putting on it right now is it would cause a fiscal that would throw things upside down. And I think perhaps you and I can help try and get something like this moving in the interim, because I agree with you. I think it would be useful. We do want to make sure that the prices we're able to produce under the program is significant. And Walmart's changed a lot of things around with their $4 prescription price, and I think that's going to be interesting to see how that all shakes up before we're done.
Indeed, Mr. Chair, and in the interest of full disclosure, as I think most of you know, I also represent Walmart, but I'm not here in that capacity today.
I didn't ask you for that. No, you told me that, but I forgot.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I just inquire a little bit further? Now, not pursuing this cost comparative piece, which would benefit consumers, mm-hmm. you indicate that would create a fiscal. So the fiscal in the context of benefiting consumers as we
fiscal in the context of the bill. We have a bill now without a fiscal that will serve a lot of consumers in important ways. And I suggest we move it rather than confusing adding a fiscal for something that's somewhat extraneous from the specific purpose of this bill.
Well, I
think
I
we still have time to address an individual bill to do that. We have lots of time, and I would be happy to entertain that.
Well, I look forward to signing on to your priority bill then.
I was going to say the same thing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Flores. I'm ready for an motion on the dash A2.
Mr. Chair.
Wait a minute. Close. Thank you, Sandy. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 362A and open a work session on Senate Bill 362A. One of these days I'll get my training wheels off and we'll be moving along smoothly.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A3 amendments to Senate Bill 362.
Are there any objections moving the dash A2 amendments to 362?
Is it A2? Or A3?
I'm sorry, the A3 amendments.
Okay.
A3 amendments.
I think A2 is on the record, Mr. Chair. I'm prepared to vote for those.
Well, that was no. It's not A2. It's just plain 2.
Oh. Okay.
A3. Any objection?
Okay.
A3 is adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Cote.
I would move Senate Bill 362 with the dash A3 amendments for the due pass recommendation to the floor.
We have a motion on the floor to move Senate Bill 362 as amended with the A3 to the floor. Any discussion? Aaron, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Barney.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Panik.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gelford.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Chair votes aye. And Senate Bill 362A as amended is move to the floor with a new pass recommendation. And Mr. Gardner, I appreciate your comments, and we need to talk more about it. I think it's an interesting move. I know we need a character. And Representative Gelser is asked to carry this bill. And I'd be delighted to name her to carry it.
Thank you.
Anybody wants to help in that?
Is she going to wear the orange?
I will make an effort to be a character.
A character carrier.
We need more chocolate.
Closing session on Senate Bill 362A. And where are we?
Where do you want to go?
Well, Representative Kotek, you want to do 2630, 2650 now?
I would love to.
Open a work session on House Bill 2650. This comes to us from the Policy Committee, and with, I think, unanimous. Is that right?
That is right.
Yes, that is correct,
Mr. Chair.
You're the carrier. Let's go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before us today is House Bill 2650A. We worked this very diligently in the subcommittee, I believe, two public hearings, three work sessions. And what this is adding nutrition standards in our schools to address our obesity epidemic here in the state. It came out of the subcommittee with a unanimous vote, and that's because we worked very hard to make sure we were addressing issues that were raised throughout the process. We've adjusted the timeline to give schools time to prepare. We've adjusted the timeline to deal with the more complex issue of dealing with the a la carte issues in the school. What we'd be setting are some calorie requirements at the different age levels. And what this is going to do is provide healthier choices in our schools for all of our kids. And I would urge a do pass recommendation for the entire committee. And I'd be happy to take questions, because there might be some, because I haven't talked to everyone about this. So
I really do need to commend the subcommittee on this. I sat in on all those hearings, and it was an extraordinary job where people were actually listening to each other and doing things that went very well. I congratulate your family on that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sandy, do you want to describe this Dash 13? Is this a compilation of all
that? It is, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, the Dash 13 that I believe, I'm hoping you all received via email, is a combined amendment from the two separate work sessions that the subcommittee held, and in adopting a total of four amendments to two separately. And I reviewed it, and I believe it does encompass everything. It has a conceptual change of the shall to the may. So the only unfinished piece right now is getting a fiscal back, but at this point it should be a fiscal light.
Oh, that was very good, Sam.
And if we pass it out and pass it to the floor and it does come into the fiscal, which we don't think will, then we'll...
It would need
pull
to come
back and do it.
Correct. It would need to come back under reconsideration, and we would have to take according action, whether it be you folks deciding on another amendment or other actions to be determined.
We believe that amendment. That amendment will take care of any threat of a fiscal. There was some sense if we asked the Department of Education to take responsibility on a shall basis to monitor it. On a shall basis to monitor, then they would have come out with a fiscal requirement, because it would have taken a lot of staff time to do that. Changing shall to may allows them to say that they won't produce a fiscal audit.
And Mr. Chair, the department is officially neutral on the bill, just for the record.
Okay. Do we have a motion on the Dash 13s? Yes, ma'am.
The subcommittee adopted the amendments. They do not need to be readopted.
It was adopted with the conceptual change.
In the
13s.
They are in the 13s.
Was it the 13 we accepted or the 12s?
It was the 12s plus the conceptual change. So
let's adopt the 13s.
Okay.
Make that point.
We need to amend the 12s out. Is that right?
No. We just say you can adopt the 13s.
So just to make sure, because we had a lot of amendments. Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 13, which compiles all the amendments to House Bill 2650.
And that's all the amendments, right? So any amendment we have ought to be 2650 as amended by the Dash 13s that we'll be voting on.
That's correct.
Okay. Any objections to the Dash 13s? Dash 13s are, I moved into House Bill 2650. Do we have a motion on House Bill 2650?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2650 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion on that? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sat on the committee that heard this, and I'm sorry that I didn't bring this up sooner, but for purposes of the record, there's something I need to clarify based on a phone call that I received just prior to this meeting. And it is now a concern based on the language that is in page 3, lines 16 through 23 of the Dash 13 amendments to talk about when the standards apply. I received a call from the Beaverton School District, which is the district that is in my legislative district, and they're concerned about after-school child care programs that are housed in the school and whether this would apply to them, because the language reads the standards required apply to food and beverage items sold in school. And it also includes, if you look at the second sentence, includes but is not limited to the time before or after classes, and if you drop down to the end of the line, or child care programs. And their concern is that oftentimes the child care programs that are run after class hours that are housed in the school are not within their control, that they're run by independent contractors. And I'm going to rely on some information that was given to me just prior to this meeting, that the language in here that says activities in the school are primarily under the control of the school district board, and rely on that language to make a statement that this bill will not apply to those programs because they are not within the control of the school district board. But I needed to make that clear, that for the after-school programs that are housed in the school that are not run by the school, that this will not apply.
That's certainly our understanding, and was useful put on the record. And I would also suggest that you ask that question on the floor of the carrier to get the intention of the records clearly at that point.
Mr. Chair, may I clarify?
Please.
Thank you. And the representative and I did talk prior to this meeting. I just want to point out a couple things, and I'll use the Dash 13s because they're right on top here. On page 1, lines 11 through 12, the items sold in public kindergarten through grade 12. So I think that's one part of it. If those programs are selling food, which I'm assuming they're not, but they're providing some kind of snack, so I don't think this would apply. The other issue is a lot of those after-school programs, if they're child care related, are probably using, they could be using after-school and snack and meal program, which is a federally run program, so I would think that would fall under some of the issues related to the National School Lunch Program standards. So I think for those two reasons, those type of programs would be exempted from this, so I think we're good, but it's good to have that on the record.
Yeah, it's very clear. I mean, if we ever get into a question of what the legislative intent is, this is a good place to clarify that, as we do the floor tomorrow. Representative Brewer, you had a big part in this bill. Do you want to make a comment?
Well, I made a comment yesterday, but I'll do it again for the we'll use a different description this time, but I'll say what I said again yesterday. I want to really, I mean, you like yesterday? I'll be less effusive, I guess, and control my language. I just want to, this whole committee did wonderful work, in my opinion, but I really want to, and there's so many advocates, I mean, everybody deserves such huge thanks because it was such a comprehensive effort, but I really want to thank the chair of the subcommittee, Representative Kotek, for her management style and how she brought all this together. You know, when this was laid out, it was laid out not necessarily as the final answer because it's a fairly substantial change to Oregon statute, and we knew we didn't have all the right answers when we rolled it out. We rolled out with a starting place, and there were people who didn't like it people who loved it, people who didn't like it. But it was a starting ground, and the way that Representative Kotek managed the subcommittee process, we talked about the two public hearings, the three work sessions. It actually felt like a lot more than that. But in the final analysis, I think you have a well-crafted piece of legislation that has input from all the interested parties, all the affected parties, and I think if this were the model that were used more often in the legislature, we'd have many fewer problems. So it was just a compliment to her, and I'd say it again publicly, a large compliment to her, just, for lack of a better word, stellar management of this bill development process.
Thank you, Representative.
For those of you who don't want to bother to look up the record from yesterday, Representative Bruin referred to the vice chair as a monster.
In a good way. A big way.
Now they have a new nickname.
Mr. Chair. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Dennis Richardson. I wasn't real clear because I wasn't able to watch yesterday's proceedings as to where the proposal that was under the name the Alliance for a Healthier Generation and where that fits into the discussions, and are they opposing the bill, or are they now on board, or where is that?
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Let me clarify. So what we tried to do in this bill is align it with the Alliance for a Healthier Generation's voluntary requirements, primarily with the beverage industry. And the Oregon Soft Drink Association brought to our attention that we were following what we knew to be the current agreement with the parties at the national level, but there is some brand new language coming out probably in another week or so that talked about allowing beverages not more than 12 ounces and containing no more than 66 calories per 8 ounces in the high schools. So at their request, we added that in. They are not opposing the legislation because of that amendment, and that is on line 14, or page 3, line 14 of the Dash 13's amendment.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other discussion?
We have a I'm sorry, yes.
Mr. Chair, and I would like
to... quiet there.
I've never been accused of that. But thank you. Now I didn't hear. I would just like to give but a thumbnail of my comments yesterday, as I did vote to support this this bill. In my disappointment that we have to have this bill, philosophically it probably conflicts with some things that I would agree and disagree on. I'm disappointed that we didn't have better buy-in by nutrition departments in the school districts across the state. I'm disappointed that we have to do this because there isn't better education models in place to focus on the importance of nutrition for our children, not only in their education system, but also in our homes, as we as parents are falling down on the job in doing what needs to be done. And all of those things bring me to a level of reluctant support, I guess, but realizing that this is probably a right direction to go at this time.
Thank you very much, Representative Flores. I said yesterday, I really couldn't agree with you more. This isn't something that we ought to have to have told the schools, but they ought to think about the nutrition of the kids that they're serving.
And I would just add also, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to do that, is that I know that some of the school districts are going to have some significant heartburn because they feel that this is yet another erosion of their local determination making, their local control issue. And I hope that with the assurances of the nutrition experts who brought this bill forward, that there will be some great collaborative work going on to bring them into the areas within the realms that we're setting forth here. So.
That's true. We did have on the record yesterday from a representative of the Community Health Partnership that there would be resources available for any of the school districts that need help and moving in that direction, and we did appreciate that, and we'll hold them to that. Any other questions?
Yes,
Representative. Thank you. Not a question, but a comment, since we're thumbnailing our comments from yesterday. Yes, I appreciated all of the yogurt parfaits that were brought, and I'm pleased to know that kids will be able to eat yogurt parfaits at school. But I wanted to kind of build on Representative Flores's comments previously and to acknowledge first that I was a little nervous about moving forward with this bill because of some of those issues of local control, and I am convinced that this is consistent with the standards in my district and the values of the folks in my district. But I do want to acknowledge that for some school districts, when we do policy at the state level that impacts local school districts, we don't get fiscal impact statements for what that means for local school districts. And I want to acknowledge that for some school districts, this is going to take some time and it could be an expense. But I do think that it's an important investment in our kids' health and their future. Like Representative Flores, I wish that it wasn't necessary for us to do this. And I think one of the turning points for me in this process was talking to my kids. I have kids in school, and talked to my 8-year-old and asked her, what do you think about if we made a rule for the state about what you ate at school? And that was when she raised to me that one of her only choices as a vegetarian to eat through her public school is a giant pretzel with cheese dipping sauce. And she didn't feel like that was very healthy. And I know that this doesn't address that because we're not addressing the federal lunch program, and I hope that we can come back in future sessions to revisit how we can, perhaps with some general fund contribution, support getting some healthy food to those kids that are relying on that as their only hot meal every day. But I'm pleased to have come around to supporting this bill, and I think it's going to be a good thing for our kids, and I'm grateful for the school districts that are going to take the time to make this work, and just wanted to acknowledge that there will be some expense expended by the school districts, and we should always be cognizant of that when we're making changes that impact our districts.
Thank you.
If I may, I have to, Mr. Chair, final word. I agree that this is a shift for some schools, but we're going to see savings in the end, and this is a good public health bill, so I'm just very appreciative that we have something that I think there's going to be a lot of support for on the House floor, so thank you, everyone.
Thank you. We have a motion on the floor?
Yes, we do.
We do.
All in favor of the motion will respond with aye. Opposed, no. Aaron, will you please call the roll?
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gelson.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. House Bill 2650 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, and I thank you all, including all the folks from the advocacy groups that worked very hard to make this happen.
And, Mr. Chair, I think Representative Bruin and I would like to carry it.
That's what I was assuming was going to happen, so please share the carrying, or the carrying, whichever.
I'm going to block. She's going to carry.
We're going to have visual aids. It'll be fun.
Green, definitely.
Yeah, we need to pass out healthy snacks. Everybody is a part of that.
I'm now eating chocolate.
Let's do some easy things if we can. If they are easy, yeah. We have two bills that extend the sunset on assessments, the hospital tax and the Medicaid managed care tax. It's important to note that we really have not dealt with these substantively, that we don't have firm agreement from either the hospitals or I think the MCO community is probably pretty good about this. But it appeared after discussions with the chair of the Revenue Committee that the proper place to work these is in the Revenue Committee rather than here. And what I would ask from my committee, if we could pass these on to the Revenue Committee, which has subsequent assignments to us, without I think without a recommendation would be fine. So first let me open a work session on House Bill 2177, and we'll ask for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move House Bill 2177 to the Revenue Committee with no recommendation.
I have a motion. Any discussion on that? Aaron, will you please call the roll?
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Gelson.
Aye.
Representative
Maurer.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2177 is passed to the Revenue Committee, the House Revenue Committee, without a recommendation. Then I'll close the work session on 2177. Open a work session on House Bill 2183. Looking for a motion. How about another motion for you, Representative Gelser? You did that so nicely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill 2183 to the Revenue Committee with no recommendation.
Is there any discussion on that motion? Those in favor of moving to the Revenue Committee, please respond aye. Those opposed, no. Aaron, will you call the roll?
Representative
Bonamici. Aye.
Representative Brill.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Gelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. I close the work session on House Bill. I lost the number. 2183 is moved to the House Committee on Revenue. And I close the work session on House Bill 2183. And just to point out that who says we can't move fast as long as we're just passing the buck? It's very easy. Okay. Let's open a work session, save us some easy ones for a while, and open a work session on SB 147, Representative Kotek. We bring that from the Policy Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 147, we heard briefly in our committee. It passed out of the Senate, 27 aye votes, 2 nay votes. And in subcommittee, it's a very simple bill. It changes the name of the Board of Medical Examiners for the state to the Oregon Medical Board. And there was really limited discussion, but it's an idea to make the board more understandable and just make it applies better to where they are today, and that's why they want the name change. So.
It'll take us all 4 years to remember that it has a new name.
And just for the record, there was a commitment from the BM, from the board, that they will use all their letterhead before they order new letterhead.
Right, that's right.
we asked them that question. We're frugal. We have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 147 with a due pass recommendation to the House floor.
Any discussion? All right, we have a motion on the floor. Those in favor of the motion respond aye when their name is called. Those opposed, no. Karen, will you please call the roll?
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Gilson. Aye.
Representative Mauer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. Senate Bill 147. The motion passes, and Senate Bill 147 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Seemed to be a logical candidate for the consent calendar. Mm-hmm. Unless there's any objection.
We need a motion.
Mr. Chair,
do we need a motion for the consent calendar?
Technically, we do.
All right, let's take it.
I would move that Senate Bill 147 be placed on the consent calendar.
Any objection? Senate Bill 147 will be placed on the consent calendar. Maybe we will get 9 bills done today. I don't want to get optimistic yet.
We've got a couple minutes.
How about Senate Bill 163. Senate Bill 163, we didn't have time to vote on it, and we moved that out of the subcommittee to the full committee for action today. Madam Administrator, will you describe Senate Bill 163, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, we had a public hearing on Senate Bill 163A on the 19th of March. That and what the bill is doing is it is permitting the exchange of protected health information between the health services organizations and the state health plan for the purpose of providing integrated behavioral and or physical health services. It does have an emergency clause and is effective upon passage. It left the Senate floor with 27 aye votes and 3 no votes. It has no fiscal or revenue, and we heard from the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, as well as the Department of Human Services, in support of this bill. I believe that the subcommittee has written testimony on that, and there was no opposition to the bill when we received public testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Just to clarify, I believe that it passed the Senate without any no votes. There were 3 excused.
Excuse me. Thank you. There were 3 excused.
Yes. It's basically to allow patient relevant information to be passed when there's a need to share information for the benefit of the patient. I'll take a motion on this bill.
Mr. Chair, I have a question
on
this bill. Go ahead. Is there, and I can understand the need to facilitate a transfer of information and to unburden the patient from having to sign a new release every single time. But what's the mechanism to protect the patient from information being transmitted between providers that maybe they don't want transmitted between different providers? We're talking about behavioral information and medical information. How will they be notified that this is happening, and do they have the option of signing something that says they don't want their information released without authorizing that to happen?
Do we have somebody from the state that could join us for this discussion? Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. My name is Walter Schaefer, and I'm the medical director for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. And to Representative Gelser's question, I mean, there's an entire set of statutes that provides protection for health records and for mental health records. So this bill is just allowing the exchange of information in this particular setting between healthcare organizations. there wouldn't be any mechanism for notifying the particular individual. Sometimes this exchange of information will be aggregated information. I think the easiest thing might be to give you an example, because we're trying to get mental health organizations and physical health organizations to work together, and so physical health organization may do a screening for depression in their patients, and they may want to share the results of that screening with a mental health organization that might be providing services in their area. So so some of it will be aggregated information. Some of it, this bill could cover individually identifiable information that might need to be exchanged in an emergency type of situation where two organizations are working together. An example of that might be if a physical health plan has a pharmacy program and a individual is having a reaction to that medication, and the pharmacy program needs to authorize a substitute medication, they might need to know whether the medicine is used for a mental health diagnosis or a physical health diagnosis. And currently, the mental health agency might have trouble releasing that information without this bill. So, they could not release the information, or, well, basically, they could not. That's right, without a signed consent.
The situation now is we have, in many parts of our state, under OMAP, two different managed care organizations providing care to the same patients because of the carve-out of mental health. Is that
That's right.
My understanding? Mm-hmm. So that you have one organization providing care for physical health and one organization providing care for mental health, and notwithstanding any of the HIPAA and other kind of safeguards that are involved in this, we have a state statute situation that doesn't allow information to flow. This doesn't change HIPAA requirements or anything else. It simply takes away a statutory barrier from information flowing.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, I'm probably going to vote no on this bill, and I just want to explain why. I understand the concern about the efficiency and recognize I might be the one of only 90 people, but as an advocate for families who have kids with very complex medical needs, I've spent years counseling families to be extraordinarily cautious about and even advising them not to sign releases between medical organizations and schools, because I have seen instances where those have been misused and there have been things that people have not wanted shared with others, and I think on this quick face value, I don't understand where those protections are for people that may have genetic, behavioral, mental health, or other needs that they may not wish to share with everyone that is seeing them. And I believe it should be up to the patients to determine whether they want that information released. And for our vulnerable populations, I think this is especially true.
Okay, any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, yes. Thank you. I guess I have a question. And this points out a bigger system issue for me, because we do have a bifurcation between our primary care and our mental health. Now, that's not true for all managed cares. We have a few MCOs that do both, is my understanding. But in general, if you're a Orient Health Plan patient, you've got a managed care plan, then you have a mental health organization assigned to you. Does the person who's would be involved in this exchange of information, do they sign an authorization for the mental health organization as well as the primary care managed care plan? And so they are signing authorization with both of them, and that therefore in some ways is saying there is some sharing going on, or am I just misreading that? What this does is you don't have... Well, when someone signs up with a plan, they probably sign some kind of authorization around their medical records, I would assume. This allows the cross sharing with the two organizations that they've already signed some kind of information waiver with. Is that inaccurate, or?
Well, Representative Kodak, whenever information is needed in the care of a individual between two providers, that information is exchanged, is authorized by signing a consent by the patient. So that is generally done. But what this bill is addressing is ways of coordinating care between plans so that we break down some of the silos that we have between mental health and physical health delivery systems. It's more for coordination of care, planning of joint projects between mental health and physical health organizations to deliver more integrated care to people. So it's more addresses some of the parts of the system that aren't allowed to exchange information now. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, they would not. I mean, when you enroll in an HMO, you don't sign a consent that allows that HMO to give somebody else information.
No, I understand that. I guess I don't think I made myself clear. At what point is there any notification that there's a possibility that this information will be shared with the passage of this bill?
Not to my knowledge, no. I mean, the bill will allow that passage of information without the specific signed consent of the person, of the individual.
But they wouldn't be notified? Well, I understand the sign-off authorization, just mm-hmm. the notification issue, that there is a chance that your information could be shared with your... without having to actually sign off. I guess I'm the notification versus the authorization.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kodak, I don't specifically know the answer to that. I don't believe there's any specific notification, but I can research that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I guess... it would be the case if I enroll in a managed care organization today, I would assume, and I guess I'm speaking only about myself, but I think it would be true for most people, that information would be shared without my authorization between my primary care physician and specialists operating within the same managed care organization. This bill, if it passes, would sort of extend the license for that kind of sharing without specific authorization from me to other specialty care practitioners, such as mental health providers. Is that an accurate
yes.
understanding of...
Yes, I would say, Representative Cannon, that's an accurate description.
So I guess my question, and maybe for other members of the committee, and particularly Representative Gelzer, would be, why we want to reinforce a wall or sort of a division of firewall, if you will, between the mental health part of my managed care organization and the physical health physical health of
can I respond to that, Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair,
well, yes,
may I respond?
Go for it.
All right. We're just talking here, right?
That's a bunch of folks calling each other.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cannon. I've had some experience with a lot of back and forth information between many specialists and a variety of different types of coverage plans. And if we take my child from his primary care physician to his neurosurgeon to his urologist to his nephrologist, I have to sign releases each time as that information goes. I'm not always willing.
Not if you're an integrated system, you know.
And
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Maurer?
Yes, in fact, you do not have to sign it each time you go from a specialist to a specialist. You only sign that once at that individual specialist, and then the primary care and the specialist can communicate until you come in and say, I no longer want you to communicate.
Correct, for each specialist, and it's not every time they communicate there has to be a conversation. However, each time I go to a new specialist or there's a release of records, and I very carefully monitor which of my son's records are allowed to go to certain people. I don't let his social work records go. I don't let his psychological evaluations go. I don't let his IQ testing go. And I think that for other people, there would be things that they wouldn't want moving between mental health and physical health. I don't have a problem with finding a way to break down the barriers. I do have a problem if you think about vulnerable populations for whom there, we heard, your committee heard testimony the other week about people with autism having services that are denied to them. There are things in your medical records that can cause difficulty for you to get coverage, that can cause difficulties in the way that people perceive you. For those of us that are physically rather healthy and mentally rather healthy, this is not an issue. For people with intellectual disabilities, for people with mental health issues, these are very real concerns that impact their health, it impacts their education. I probably have an unusual view on this, but it's if without notification, without the ability to control that information, I believe that we put those populations at risk. We compromise the confidentiality of their records, and therefore I think some of the outcomes of their treatments.
Yeah, I would just like to comment on what I think is the modern standard in integrated medical care systems now. And we're talking here about integrated medical care systems. That in most integrated medical care systems, in modern integrated medical care systems, there is or is going to be soon a single electronic medical record. And that's a goal that we're all striving to achieve. In the medical care system I belong to and have for many years, everything that's happened to somebody in a healthcare system, except for certain excluded information that's intended to be excluded, is available anytime any physician sees a patient with the intention of caring for that patient. And the basic notion is that when you see a surgeon, you don't sign a release. When you see an ophthalmologist, you don't sign a release. That information is available to them on a ready basis, including where I receive my medical care, even my email between physicians. Between me and physicians is available at any time. I had an email with my oncologist asking. My brother had been suggested my brother be checked as a potential bone marrow donor for me, and he was checked and I didn't get a result. And I sent my oncologist an email and said, "Can you tell me whether my brother is a match or not? I want to know whether I have to keep being nice to him or not." And she came back with the statement in an email that he wasn't a match, but she recommended being nice to him at least until Christmas. The point of that is every physician that's looked at, the extent to which that's a relevant information, every physician who's reviewed my medical record since has asked me, are you still being nice to your brother? I mean, in a sense, the basic notion is that in order to treat people in the complex modern world we live in, the basic medical information needs to pass between members of the care team. And within either of these two silos, the information will pass. The only question is, should it pass between the two silos? Because internally, most of them now have modern medical records where the information does pass. Senator Kotek, you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am in full support of finding ways to integrate behavioral and physical health. And I have Kaiser, and there's an expectation in Kaiser, if I had an issue that I needed to see someone on their mental health staff, that I understand that my records share with my, that is an integrated system. I would not be surprised, but I would know that there was that sharing. Can I ask a question? This only applies to the Oregon Health Plan patients?
Representative Kodak, yes, it only applies to Oregon Health Plan patients in that is contained in the definitions of prepaid managed care health services organizations, which are basically the way the Department of Human Services contracts for physical health care, dental health care, and managed mental health care. So basically it's Oregon Health Plan. Yes.
Can I follow up?
Please.
Thank you. I mean, this gets back to my earlier comment. We have structurally set up siloing in the way we've done our contracts. And
it's completely crazy.
Hmm?
It's completely crazy.
It is completely crazy. However, I would have a lot more comfort to know that the person in the health plan was aware that their records were going to be shared in a way. This could be seeming a little paternalistic to say, we'll just share your records and just trust us. And, you know, that's really concerning. And maybe I'm misreading this, but we're trying to make up for some structural issues, and we do want the best care for our clients, but it would be good to ask them.
Or tell them.
Or tell them.
Can I respond to that?
Yes, please.
Okay, Representative Kotick. you know, there are 4 or 5 pages of statutes that specifically deal with protections for mental health records release, and those aren't being changed. And there are 4 or 5 pages of the privacy rules in the state statutes for the physical health and general health records. So this bill is designed to allow that exchange of information only in this pretty narrow arena, and only for the purposes of breaking down some of those barriers between the silos that we've created, so that we can do a better job of providing health to people with chronic mental illness and chronic physical illness, which we're doing not a very good job now of coordinating those, you know, those two types of services. So this has been identified as a significant barrier in the mental health and physical health organizations trying to collaborate. So this is something that's being, this bill is being supported by, you know, both the mental health organizations and the physical health organizations. So,
Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to preface this by admitting that I have probably the least amount of experience with healthcare issues of anybody on this committee. So, I really need somebody to explain to me the relationship between the silos that you're talking about. Because, and I think it could be done by telling me what another means in line 9 of the bill. Because it's talking about sharing the records with another prepaid managed care health services organization. So what I want to find out is when the patient signs the initial consent and forms, well, is there any expectation that even once this bill passes that the records are going to be shared with another prepaid managed care health services organization? So I don't understand the relationship between, I don't understand that what another means and what this, how the silos are connected, if at all.
You have a patient, and we heard from, let's say, in Marion County, who's assigned to the Oregon Health Plan, and they're assigned to the, what's the Marion County?
Marion Pope Community Health Plan.
Community Health Plan. They join up to that health plan. But if it turns out they need mental health services, that's not where they get the mental health services. They get the mental health services from another prepaid managed care organization that has a carve-out for the mental health diagnosis. The time they sign up with the physical health, they may or may not know they're going to need mental health services. But somewhere along the line, when they do, they'll get the mental health services from what? From another organization, right? Marion County, somebody knows?
Oh, yes, from Marion County Mental Health.
So the question is, at the time they sign up with the physical health, they might not ever know they're going to need mental health services. But when they do, they're going to get them in a different organization. But that's the other.
Can I ask a follow-up question, please, Mr. Chair? So is it somehow burdensome to have them sign another consent form when they go to get the mental health services to say, release my records from the other place?
Well,
the other silo?
It might be burdensome if what one silo is trying to do is to alert the other silo that there's a problem.
mean, that's basic. What they're trying to do is organize services between these. If they were in a single silo, if we didn't have a carve-out, this wouldn't be a problem.
Right.
They'd be in one organization, and when they needed mental health services, the record would be available to the psychiatrist there.
Mr. Chair? You've just made my point. I mean, I think that an individual should be able to choose whether or not they wish to seek help, and I don't think it's appropriate for medical organizations to come in and decide what's best for a patient, a consumer, without that consumer's consent and help. We shouldn't be creating structures that without the permission of or the knowledge of individuals receiving services, we are alerting behind their backs to somebody else information that we think is important to share when they might not want that information shared.
If they were in a single organization, it would just be automatic. The only thing that makes
and
us different
that's a problem
is,
too.
Is we divide it.
But
well,
they would have knowledge.
But that's
that
the problem.
But
we're knowledge of what?
They would have knowledge that there's more than one service provided with that provider. I mean, when I go to Kaiser, I know I'm going to get everything, and I'm assuming everything is shared. That's kind of the glory of Kaiser. That is not the case if in case of a health plan patient.
I don't know if it is or it isn't.
But, Mr. Chair, when the patient is at silo one, and I kind of feel like I'm in a farm, but if the patient is at the first provider, and the provider is saying, we're sending you over to get mental health services, why can't they just say, so would you please sign this release so we can send you records? I don't understand why that's a problem.
That's exactly what happens in that type of situation. This is related more to how the systems work together. Let me give you an example that we're trying to promote, because we're actually trying to have all of the mental health organizations and physical health organizations do collaborative projects together. A co-location of providers is one example that we can focus on, where suppose a mental health organization wants to put one of their mental health providers in a physical health clinic. In order to know which clinic there's the greatest need, they might want to know what's the rate of people with depression, what's the rate of people with bipolar disorder in this clinic or in this zip code. And so the physical health organization may have that information, but without this bill, they would not be able to share that information with the mental health organization that is trying to decide where to put their mental health provider. We've just created barriers that prevent that sort of integration.
It's a very different situation than Mr. Chair.
I'm going to. We don't have time for long discussions today. What I'm going to do is I'm going to move Senate Bill 163 back to the Policy Committee, since the three members that are the most skeptical didn't hear the long discussion we had in the other committee, and there's no point in trying to recreate that, and we'll put it back to the Policy Committee, and you'll decide whether this represents good health care or it doesn't represent good health care. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 163 and ask the Administrator to schedule this for further work in the policy subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are we going to have the same kind of problems with Senate Bill 230, Representative Co-Chair? Okay. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 230. This was heard in your committee, your subcommittee, I think. So we'll see if the other subcommittee members can start objecting to it. I think it is going to be a problem if we end up having to rehear everything that was in one subcommittee and the whole committee.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we're out of trouble.
Okay,
this
great.
Is a housekeeping issue.
All right. Let's do it.
Jog my memory here. So Senate Bill 230 was brought to us by the State Board of Psychologist Examiners. There was some issue around how they were doing. They wanted to clarify dues requirements as it relates to the pain management education as part of their continuing education requirement. And the way it was originally amended was it created a technical problem around the renewal of a license as it relates to having completed the pain management course. And so what the bill does is it allows for a phase. You want to help me out here, Sandy?
I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair. Senate Bill 230, there was, when we passed some language in previous, with previous legislation, they put in a they put in language for the psychologist to get renewal that they had to take their pain management class prior to the renewal process. That has proven to be problematic because the board wants to allow their licensees some flexibilities on getting their continuing education requirements or education requirements. So the language prior to removal has caused some difficulty for the board and their licensees. This bill clearly just removes that language prior to taking it out because it had that unintended consequence. Thus, it was a housekeeping. It was of the housekeeping nature. It left the subcommittee unanimously. There is no revenue. There is no fiscal. And does that help?
It does. I mean, okay. The goal is to have people take their pain management education. It's just not something that needs to be timeline connected to the renewal.
Correct.
And so they wanted to just clarify that because it was causing a problem.
Okay.
Stimulating stuff. So.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 230 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the recommendation that it go on the consent calendar.
That has to be a separate motion.
Oh, a separate motion. Wasn't in judiciary.
Okay. We have a motion on the floor to move Senate Bill 230 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Erin, will you please call the roll?
Representative
Bonnie. Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
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 Vice Chair
Cortez.
Aye.
Vice
Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Green. Aye. Senate Bill 230 is moved. Received affirmative votes. And we'll move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I would move that bill, Senate Bill 230, be placed on the consent calendar.
That one.
We have a motion to place Senate Bill 230 on the consent calendar. Is there any objection?
No.
So moved.
There's
a work commission on Senate Bill 230. I'm going to open a work session on HJR 18 for the main purpose today of discussing an amendment Representative Richardson has the HJR 18, and then we'll close the work session after we do that and hold it for another day. So I would open a work session on HJR 18. HJR 18 is a proposal of mine to move an amendment to the Oregon Constitution that declares access to health care as a fundamental right of every legal resident of Oregon and directs the Legislative Assembly to adopt a plan expanding health care coverage to meet that objective. And Representative Richardson, you have an amendment, is that right? Which I think we all have.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm referring to the HJR 18-5 amendment. And basically, this would be adding one sentence to the resolution. That one sentence would say, a plan adopted by the Legislative Assembly under this section may not limit the right of residents to purchase their own health care coverage or health care. And the reason that this is being proposed is, in looking at the resolution, and it, you know, we're understanding that this would be sent out to the voters throughout the state, there's going to be a lot of confusion as to what the real intent is, and there will be many, I believe, who will be afraid that the intent is really to just open the door for complete single-payer socialized medicine, which would be an affront to many of the voters. And by adding this sentence, it basically assures that if this becomes a constitutional right, there will be the right of free enterprise to still be involved in the right of individuals to purchase their own policies or to upgrade or to buy their own care, and that they won't have to rely solely on government-provided care.
Is there any questions on Representative Richardson's amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Perhaps a comment. I guess at first blush, it appears this may be wise, for the reasons that Representative Richardson suggests. I think particularly as there is more conversation both in this building and around the state about health care reform and universal health care reform, and it's important also to signal to voters that that should not be confused with a limitation on people's ability to purchase the health care that they see fit. So whether or not this belongs in the Oregon Constitution or not is, maybe haven't entirely made up my mind, but I certainly see the wisdom of sending a very strong signal to voters that we do not intend to abridge their right to purchase health care.
And none of the interesting thing is none of the universal access proposals we're considering, mostly over in the Senate,
would do that.
That's right. Exactly right. Yeah. Can I hear a motion to adopt that amendment, Representative Richardson?
Mr. Chair, I would move the adoption of the Dash 5 amendment into House Joint Resolution 18.
Is there any discussion on that?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I will support the Dash 5 amendments to House Joint Resolution 18, so I will save my comments in regard to the fundamental premise of the bill, of the resolution, to the point in time when we will be discussing this, because I will not be supporting the resolution.
Save that for another day, yes.
Just good. Putting you on notice.
Good, excellent.
Thank you.
Any objection to adopting the Dash which?
Five.
The Dash 5 amendments to HJR 18? So moved. I close the work session on House Joint Resolution 18. Yes, did I hear?
Thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Representative Richardson, for bringing it forward. I open a work session on House Bill 2386. It comes to us from the Policy Committee, and Representative Brewer, you're carrying it, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2386 comes to you unanimously from the Policy Subcommittee. It does basically two things after a series of amendments. The first thing is that it allows any physical therapist who's received an academic distinction of a doctorate level in physical therapy to call themselves doctor. That's the first thing. The second thing it does is extend the period to which a physical therapist has to refer a patient back to a medical doctor. It extends that period from 30 days, which is current statute, to 45 days.
There was great work on this, and Vice Chair Kotek did a great job managing it after I spent a lot of time mucking it up.
Not at all. My earlier comments, Mr. Chair.
And just to clarify, the Dash 6 amendments that we have contain the conceptual amendment to the Dash 4s that we made yesterday. So do we need to move the Dash 6s?
It wouldn't hurt, Madam.
I would move the Dash, then, if I may. I move the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 2386.
Thank you. We have a motion on the floor to move the Dash 6 amendments. Is there any discussion?
Yes. Mr. Chair, can I ask Representative Brune to clarify or repeat? It's really not clarify. I just wasn't listening closely enough to the first part of the explanation about what it does with the term doctor.
Right now, a physical therapist that has achieved a doctorate level of education by statute is not allowed to call themselves Dr. Jones. This passing would allow that person to call themselves Dr. Jones.
Would it apply, follow up, Mr. Chair, would it apply to any other categories of folks who have attained a doctorate degree? Or is this limited to physical therapy?
Limited to physical therapists. I see.
Can I refer you to Section 1 of the bill? Section 1 of the bill is Section 676110, which it turns out defines who can use the title doctor. And it's been amended several times for veterinary medicine and a variety of other people who have earned doctorates, optometry, naturopathic physician, and it gives them, with each amendment, the right to use the term doctor of something. We're going to have a bill before us that allows acupuncturist to use the term doctor of acupuncture and oriental medicine, DAOM, and again, it'll be an amendment to this. What this section does is it adds, as you can see in that hand engrossed version, it adds a section 10, which gives the doctors of physical therapy the right to use the title doctor.
And just to clarify, the person would be licensed with the physical therapy board and have a doctoral degree in physical therapy to be able to say, I'm a doctor and a doctor of physical therapy.
And thank you. Just for further clarification, what I was just trying to append to Representative Bruin's statement is they may not say simply doctor. They must
doctor
say
physical
doctor
therapy,
of physical
okay.
therapy.
Well, I expect they'll be called doctor in individual exchange, but when they have a card or on the sign or something, it'll say...
And that's the whole intent of this legislation.
Which is
exactly.
Doctor of physical therapy. Right.
Thank you, Dr. Greenman.
As it has evolved.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the healthcare system being called doctor. I realized I've been in violation of this.
Do some hard time.
For a long time. Okay. We have a motion to adopt the Dash 6 amendments. Any objection?
No, I have a question, though. There, in addition to the Dash 3 and Dash 4, unlike the other bill, they're not cumulative, correct?
I'm sorry, they're not what?
Cumulative. They don't encompass the Dash 3 and Dash 4. They're in addition to?
The Dash 6?
Yes.
No, they are the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 with that
okay.
extensive
right.
conceptual amendment of deleting part of the Dash 4 that we did. So LC did a fabulous turnaround time of
Thank
under
you.
24 hours of combining the two amendments.
Most of what those Dash amendments do is say they... won't amend 688020 as Section 3 did, and they won't do 688030 as Section 4 did. So basically, it says, let's not fool around with those. And then adds the 45 days on page 3, line 36. We think that's what it says. We're pretty
no.
sure.
Committee members, there was a lot of debate about some of the other content in the bill, and so... the Physical Therapy Association was willing to make some changes. I would assume we'll be back on some of the other issues next session. So that's why that we took
out. Just got another proposed bill.
We're just dealing with the two issues around 45 days for direct access and using the term doctor of physical therapy.
Do we have a motion on House Bill 2386?
We need to move the amendments.
I thought we did move them. Did we not move the amendments?
No.
Any objection to the Dash 6? Dash 6 moved. Seven amendment?
Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2386 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion on the floor to move House Bill 2386 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, is there did the committee hear any opposition to this as amended?
No, and we've been individually assured that as it is here, the opposition went away. There was lots of opposition to the original.
And to credit the association, there was some concern about the direct access and number of days originally. Physical therapists wanted to eliminate all days. It was 30 in the existing statutes going to 45. That was through discussion with primarily the Oregon Medical Association. So at this point, everyone's fine with the bill. So a good question. Thank you.
We have a motion on the floor. Those in favor... respond aye. Those opposed, no. Okay, will you please call the roll?
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gilson.
Aye.
Representative Howard.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kotek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Greenlee.
Aye. House Bill 2386, having the required votes, who's going to carry it?
I'd be happy to carry it again.
Okay. Representative Bruin will carry it. One more bill. It's amazing. It's 22 minutes after 4, and we have one more bill before us, which might take a little time. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 200, and I'm going to invite testimony from the Board of Pharmacy and also from Frank Musso. Let's start with Frank, if you will.
Board of Pharmacy want to join us?
Can I do a description from the sub?
Mr. Chair, okay. It may be helpful for the other the committee members who haven't been involved to have a summary. And would you like me to do that or Sandy to do
it? We have a carrier in that room.
That'd be great. Thank you.
We would like you to do it.
Thank you.
I'm sorry I didn't ask.
That's all right. It's just with the subcommittees. Not everybody has the benefit of sitting through the prior testimony. This is a Senate Bill 200. The Oregon Board of Pharmacy, it increases the maximum amount of the civil penalty that can be assessed by the State Board of Pharmacy. This passed the Senate. There were a few no votes. I lost my piece of paper. It's 22-5 with three excused. And it came out of the Senate with increase in the civil penalty to $1,000. There was an $5,000, and there was an amendment here that was proposed to us to change that civil penalty into two levels, $1,000 for an offense that's committed by an individual and $10,000 for an offense committed by a drug outlet. And we had testimony about why that was justifiable to change from one level of penalty to two levels of penalty, so we reached the drug outlets at a higher level. And also, there's a section added, Section 3, that allows the board to take disciplinary action as the board finds proper, including but not limited to the assessment of costs in the disciplinary process. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have somebody here to testify about a concern about that because of the Administrative Procedure Act, and I think we can let our witness explain that. That is something that we did not adopt in the dash when we discussed this in the policy committee. We did not adopt that particular change to delete that. We included the change, there was a discussion about it. Yeah. Sorry, that wasn't clear.
And may I just to follow up with that, Mr. Chair? And the conclusion. Well, the conclusion was that. While there might have been some concerns about this particular addition to the board's statutes, a variety of other boards also have some troublesome statutes as it relates to disciplinary action, and so the subcommittee decided not to address that, but I hear we're going to hear testimony on that particular issue. We just decided to say there's an issue among cross boards. Somebody should deal with it with all the boards was kind of our thought, at least my thought.
Right, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure that we even reached the level of this is troublesome and it's something we need to deal with. I think what we thought was it's included in this, but it's also included in the Board of Dentistry, the Board of Nursing, the Board of Medical Examiners, the Board of Optometry, the State Veterinary Board. So it isn't unique to this particular disciplinary board.
Thank you for that clarification. That's true. We didn't really come to any value judgment
right.
on that necessarily.
Correct.
please introduce yourself for the record. And
good afternoon. My name is Frank Massell. I'm an attorney. I'm here representing the Oregon State Bar's Administrative Law Section. That is a group of attorneys that are interested in the area of administrative law. It's somewhere in excess of 200 members. I'm in private practice in Portland. I've been in private practice for 5 years, and my practice is with an emphasis on administrative law. I've been in law practice for 30 years. The 21 years before I went into private practice, I was an assistant attorney general, and I was assigned to a number of professional licensing boards, including the Board of Dentistry, the Board of Pharmacy, and a number of others. When I was the board's lawyer, I was absolutely confident that we were doing God's work. I think we were. I think the Board of Pharmacy continues to do God's work, and SB 200 is part of that effort. And the point of SB 200 is that the board is attempting to enhance its ability to deal with wholesalers, drug outlets that are wholesalers who are dealing in prescription drugs in the gray market. The provision of the bill that we're concerned about, we have no, the bar takes no position in regards to the increase in the civil penalty and no issue on the issue of expanding the board's jurisdiction. As a personal matter, that makes, just as an aside, that makes some sense to me in terms of their efforts to deal with wholesalers in the gray market. The issue of assessing costs, however, is entirely unrelated to that issue, and in our view is not God's work, and so we're opposing that piece of the bill. The board's authority to regulate is predicated on and funded by licensing fees by pharmacists, pharmacist technicians, interns, and drug outlets. The cost provision will, by definition, place a portion of that of those regulatory costs onto individuals who are the subject of a disciplinary proceeding. And the and we believe that that's bad public policy, and it's bad public policy for a hugely important reason, which is that it places a burden on the person who is the subject of the board's proposed action to face having to not only pay the expenses of their own defense, but also to have to pay the attorney's fees for the board, and to be confronted with the sanctioning authority of the board. And it creates a huge chilling effect for those persons who are subject to the licensing boards who currently do have the authority to impose the costs of these proceedings on their licensees. At my last count, there were 7 boards who had this authority. I believe it is not correct that the nursing board currently has this authority, and I think that there are 20-plus other boards which do not have this authority. The consequences of imposing these costs, or the threat, is the critical issue here. The threat of these costs just creates a chilling effect on any person who is forced to defend themselves before a licensing board. And so by the time in the first interview we talk to our clients and we tell the client, the board has brought these charges, they have the authority to revoke your license, suspend your license, place you on probation, impose a civil penalty of $1,000 per violation, or, depending on the board, significantly more. And in addition to that, given that the board is the prosecutor and the judge in the case who's going to make the final decision, is that if the board thinks that there is any basis for disciplining you, regardless of what happens in the hearing before the administrative law judge, you're going to lose. And no matter how ill-considered the allegations are against a licensee or how ill-considered the proposed sanction is that the client looks at you and says, what's the point? There's your fees and the costs of mounting the defense. There will be the sanction imposed on me at the end of this process. And if I lose in any respect, I will also now have to pay the attorney's fees for the board and the other expenses associated with that that proceeding. For that reason, we believe that this is a terrible idea. The bill, nevertheless, has an additional defect, which is it simply violates the fundamental principles of administrative law. And those principles are that state government and administrative agencies and licensing boards in particular should be subject to principled decision-making that are based on clear standards which have been adopted in advance of the decision-making. And due process of law, which is the other prong of administrative law that is so important, is that you're entitled to notice and hearing before you are subjected to a deprivation imposed by the government. And these features are essential in order to avoid arbitrary and capricious government action. This bill does not provide a definition of the costs of the disciplinary process. There is no post-hearing procedure for assessing the costs, and there's no procedure for a licensee to contest either the accuracy or the reasonableness of the costs that have been purportedly incurred by the ward. And the decision to assess the costs of the imposition, the decision to assess the costs is discretionary with the board, and there are no legislative guidelines to control how the board exercises that discretion. So in this regard, if you determine that the board should have this authority to assess the cost of a disciplinary proceeding, the authority should be limited to cases in which the licensee's defense of a disciplinary action is determined to have been made in bad faith or is wholly frivolous, so that this is a determination that it's a baseless defense. And there should be a post-hearing procedure for the licensee to contest that contention that the defense was made in bad faith or was frivolous. And so our position, and we urge you to simply delete the provision of costs, the ability to assess costs from this bill, or if that's not a satisfactory resolution on this issue, that the matter go back to the subcommittee for consideration of appropriate amendments to provide for due process processes, articulated standards, so that the professionals who are subjected to disciplinary proceedings before the Board of Pharmacy have clear standards applicable and can address these issues. I would be thank you for taking the time to hear us and hear our presentation, and I'd be happy to respond to your questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, you had some similar questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I do apologize. I want to correct the record. I was reading this my piece of paper that was provided at the public hearing incorrectly, and the Board of Nursing does not. So thank you you know more about this than I do, and thank you for correcting that. You mentioned something about the attorney's fees, and I understand I think of costs and attorney's fees as separate, and I understand this is a different situation because you have attorneys who are with the board. Is that correct, or are you anticipating a separate assessment of costs and a separate assessment of attorney fees?
Chair Greenlich and Representative Bonamici, costs is undefined in the bill. It is also undefined in the statutes of the other seven state agencies that have this authority, and the Court of Appeals not too long ago in a case where this very issue was raised by a licensee of the Board of Medical Examiners, the Court of Appeals said that this is a statutory term. It is not limited to the typical definition of costs in a civil proceeding in circuit court, and it includes the costs of the board's lawyer, which is of course the Oregon Department of Justice, the assigned Assistant Attorney General.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You go as long as you work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Until 5 o'clock.
And can you please explain whether the other boards have the guidance that you're asking for? If we leave this in and you're asking for guidance, do the other boards have that guidance?
I'm assuming that
they probably don't, or there wouldn't be the case of the court.
Yes, Chair Greenlich and Representative Bonamici, they do not. The statutes in each of the cases, in the six that I've had time to look up today, simply refer to the costs of the proceeding. And there's no definition, and there are no procedures provided in those either. And that's something that desperately, in my judgment, desperately thinks needs to be addressed and rectified.
How long have those been in effect?
I'm not sure how long the oldest one is. I don't know when the first one was adopted, but I'm willing to guess at least 10 years ago. The Board of Dentistry. Obtained that authority.
Certainly long enough to get a case up to the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. Do we have... Mr. Chair, do we have... Oh, there's somebody on there. We'll take a question from somebody on the phone.
Representative Richardson, is that you?
It's Representative Richardson.
Yes, go ahead.
I would like to just say I am so grateful that Mr. Musil was willing to come forward and point this out, because as an attorney, I tell you, it's absolutely chilling to think that a person would go before a board and they're accused of some problem, and that based on what they say or how they conduct their defense, it's completely subjective, that they may end up having to pay not only their own costs, but also be subject to the cost of those bringing the proceeding against them. I mean, there's an inherent conflict of interest by the board, because should they pay for it out of their budget, or should they assess it to someone that they've accused to begin with, and then not have any appeal or any way to determine what the charges might be beforehand. I mean, I feel that this bill, while it may have good intentions, it's a real violation of basic rights for citizens, and I would hope that we not allow this kind of provision that's being proposed in Section 1, Paragraph 3, to go forward. And then there's another question as far as the increase on the potential penalty, where they can assess a civil penalty. And I think the mere fact that other boards may have this ability, these other seven boards, merely means that we have more work to do to look back at them, but that it's not justification to continue this kind of practice here. It's just bad for an individual when you have the government power over the individual, and you know, it just would make a person want to feel like, what's the use, or I can't afford to stand up for my own rights because all the power is on the side of the government.
Mr. Chair, do we have someone from the Board of Pharmacy who can talk about whether what's the important part of this bill? Is it the civil penalties, or is it the part that we're talking about?
Watch out for Representative Thompson. I'm not sure you want to bring him up. Don't go too far.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Paige Clark, the pharmacist consultant with the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I was in front of the subcommittee not too long ago. To my left is Karen McLean, who is our administrative director and is here in the absence of our executive director and also our compliance director. And Karen has some interesting background that might be helpful to provide for you as well. And to my right is Jim Thompson, who represents Senator George, who initially put together the amendment that is before you, the Dash One amendment.
And also represents the Oregon State Pharmacists Association.
On some days.
So you
depends on the time of day.
I mean, I think that's an important distinction in this case, Jim, because
no, you're right.
We are talking about the rights of the pharmacists.
Right.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Karen McLean, and I am the administrative director of the board. I've been there for 5 years, and so I have a little bit of insight into how this bill was developed. I actually was primarily responsible for drafting it. We did go and research the other agencies that have the ability to assess costs, and part of what we provided to Ledge Council when we were submitting our information was draft language right out of the samples right out of the other statutes. So that is how we provided the information. We did not at the time have any discussions about how this would happen, or, you know, the understanding was that the board at a future point, once this was in place, would set guidelines for staff in response to administering administrative costs. So with that in mind, the board takes civil penalties very seriously and would also take administrative costs very seriously. The testimony that was provided by the bar at, I believe, the first hearing provided a array of how the other boards had issued administrative costs. And in our opinion, or in my opinion, the highest one was the one for the Board of Medical Examiners, but the others were actually quite limited, and there were not very many that were assessed. So I'm not sure that I agree with Mr. Massell's opinion that there would be a chilling effect on this if the board was, this were to be added to the board's statutes. In recent conversations that have occurred at the board level, amongst staff, really, the idea was that we were most interested in being able to address the issue of frivolous cases For example, I know recently I happened to be standing there. There was a contested case hearing that was requested, and I know this has happened on a number of occasions. The person did not show up, did not bother to call, and we had a hearings officer sitting in our conference room waiting for the person to appear, taking up staff time. Our attorney general came to Portland. We pay for his travel time to come to Portland, et cetera. And so all of those things in place, and the person doesn't bother to call and doesn't bother to say that they're not going to come. And the cost approximately in that case is probably $3,000 or $4,000 for all of those costs that were assessed to the state agency Board of Pharmacy, and the person doesn't even show up. That's really part of where we want to go with this, assessing the costs. The second part, I believe, is that some cases end up costing an exorbitant amount. The idea is not to use assessing costs for where there are cases that are going through the normal process, investigative courses that the board wants to take. We wouldn't assume at this point that that would be the intent of the board to assess those costs to the case or to the person.
That's working the government, right?
Well, that is not the intent. And like I said, the board's, I actually have some figures here from the 05-07 biennium of costs that have been assumed by the agency. And it's about $103,000 between hearings costs and Department of Justice costs to do the work that we do. And our goal isn't to try to recover all of this. In fact, our goal is probably not to recover a lot of it. But that is, as Mr. Massell said correctly, on the plate of the licensees. That's part of what we do. It's part of what the licensing fees are for. We don't disagree with that.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Are you a drafter of this or the proposer? In Section 1 of the original section of ORS 689445.
Mm-hmm.
Up till now, you've had two large sets of disciplinary actions, be subsection 1 and subsection 2. Let's not talk about the costing yet, but in the beginning of that line begins on line 27, in addition to the action authorized in 1 and 2, the board may take other disciplinary action as the board in its discretion finds proper. Let's talk about that. What sort of disciplinary action do you think you didn't have enough authority to in sub 1 and sub 2 of that section?
Chair Greenlick, quite frankly, I'm not sure what the answer to that question would be. I believe that is language that the Legislative Council included. I don't know that that was something
that
I
asked for. So the question
is, yes.
Was this only your intention to say, in addition to the actions authorized by subsection 1 and 2, the board may also assess the cost of the disciplinary process against the person? I mean, was that your intention? Was it only about costs? Or do you have some other bag of disciplinary action that you didn't feel was covered in sub 1 and sub 2?
Chair Greenlee, quite honestly, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I believe that we have the authority for the disciplinary process. The board has talked about incorporating these three components of this particular bill for at least 4 years since I've been around. And there are a variety of things that the board has done to eliminate those costs. They've started assessing continuing education as an alternative to a civil penalty. And that has actually been happening probably in the last 2 years that the board has elected to go in that direction. So if there is a medication error, they might require them to go get additional continuing education in that area. And that's been a very, we think that's a prudent way to address the issue and be responsible in addressing the education component in addition to addressing the person's personal learning curve.
And you don't think that could be covered under sub 1F?
Chair Greenlee, I do believe that is covered under 1F. I do. I don't know what the other things would be that are referred to in this line. I'm sorry, I just don't know.
So as we discuss this further, you wouldn't have a problem with the thing we discussed being only that you're authorized to assess costs.
I believe that is correct, yes.
I think that's still going to cause us some problems, but
mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I have some notes from our public hearing when Steve Risberger testified. I think Mr. Musil was not available that day, and Mr. Risberger made some of the same points about the concern about the assessment of costs. And he not in his written testimony, but he orally talked about some of the assessments that had been made by the other boards. And I took notes, and at the risk of relying on my notes,
I can assure you Representative Richardson has just as good notes, and we can ask him to check his as well.
This is in the subcommittee.
Representative Richardson, are you there?
Yeah, I'm wondering if we got it plugged out.
I bet we did.
And it was on the subcommittee.
It's time to let them go. If they got hung up on, we have a quorum.
For tax practitioners, there were six cases, and the assessments were between 50 and 420. Oh, 4,200.
4,200.
4,200. Yeah. And for veterinary board, there were 12 cases between 100 and 750.
1,000. I took the same number.
Okay. Dentist, up to 1,600. Medical examiners, there were three cases between 5,000 and 16,127. And chiropractors, there were eight cases between 194 and 3,000. Was that? So those are the costs that have been assessed under other cost assessment provisions.
In addition to the fine.
Correct.
In addition to the penalty.
Those were the costs. That's my understanding of what Mr. Risberger was explaining.
Are you okay if I try?
Yes. If the representative of Canada, I'd be sure he's willing to buy it.
That's right.
Do you have anything else, Marty?
Representative Maurer?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, the power strip got turned off.
Oh, okay.
We still, I believe, have a few more minutes. Do you want to hold on?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to try and get Representative Richardson back on the line. So, hold on.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Whimsical.
While we're doing that, Mr. Chair,
yes,
do you mind if I ask a quick question?
Yeah, I know.
Are you an attorney? Okay. I'm not. I was just you stated that you were challenging Mr. Musil's statements here and the legal theory, so I just wondered if perhaps you were...
This is Dennis Richardson. This is June. May I help you?
June, this is Sandy with the House Healthcare Committee. Representative Richardson got cut off, and we're trying to get him back online.
Okay, just one second.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlake, Representative Flores. No, I'm not an attorney, and I wouldn't presume to be one. I disagree,
sir,
with his assessment.
We got our power strip
and
turned off.
Just one clarification.
Yes.
Thank you.
So I think we've got you back on. Hold on.
Hello? Hello.
Hello there.
Dennis, how are you?
Good.
Glad to be back on.
Right on. Okay. We are still on Senate Bill 200. I don't think we missed a lot.
No.
Okay.
Representative Greenlake, I think the other thing that I would just add, in addition to my previous comments, is that part of what the board's desire for this component of this bill is to also use this as a negotiation tool in the process of resolving cases that happen along the way and in the disciplinary process. So there's a notice and an order that's given, and they may or may not request a hearing. And if they request a hearing, often it's resolved way before that hearing occurs. And these are things, tools, really, that the board is requesting to be able to use in the course of the process. That's really the desire of the board. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. These things range from anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 to $20,000. It just depends on what the case is.
I think, Representative, Mr. Musil was arguing that you have too many tools already.
Mm-hmm.
I think was the argument.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I don't know if there's any way for you to answer this question, but I'm interested in knowing, since the board exists, I suspect at least in part, to help protect the profession, I wonder what the position of current licensees is on this. I mean, we've heard some concern from an attorney who represents them, but I would assume the board is trying to act in order to strengthen the position of your licensee. So there seems to be sort of a contradiction between what maybe some licensees or their representatives fear and what the board is trying to do, which I would presume is in their interest. So can we get a better sense of where members, licensees are on this?
Thank you, Representative Cannon and Chair Greenlake. If I could have Jim Thompson put on his Oregon State Pharmacy hat. He is the executive director of the State Pharmacy Association that represents the professionals that we license.
And would be subject to this provision.
And that's why I did bring Jim up with me. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Thompson. I'm executive director of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I'm also the director of the statewide pharmacy coalition, which is a group, constituent group of two other organizations of pharmacists that come together for the purpose of proposing or objecting to legislation. In all fairness, I also serve as health care policy advisor to Senator George. I have for many, many years. He's my senator, and so I have both that. On the OSPA side, we took this bill and looked at it originally, and we did not have any objections to it. And the reason is that the board has been very even-handed and fair in the way they've dealt with pharmacists for a long time. That was not always the case. And we recognize that there's a possibility in the future that the board may drift, but we felt that we have adequate recourse to come back to people like you if the board's out of control and ask for other remedies in the instance that they should do something that is out of control. The bigger issue here in nationwide is the protection of our drug supply. We have out-of-control, rampant misuse of the supply system, diversion of drugs, relabeling of drugs, and it's a multi-billion dollar business in this country. And unfortunately, it's come about relatively recently, although it started a long time ago, and we've given no tools to the boards of pharmacy and other enforcers to deal with this. Someone who stands to make $5 million on an illicit drug deal in Oregon and is hit with a $1,000 fine is not likely to reform quickly. It's to their advantage to drag out the procedure as long as they possibly can by every stalling maneuver that they can invent, including not showing up for hearings. And the intent of this bill from our side was to give the board tools to represent us, because we're oftentimes unwitting victims of these kind of people, and go after them in a very serious way and maybe bring a halt to some of these practices. So in the original bill, the pharmacist, the ability to level fines to pharmacists was at $5,000. We didn't object to that because it put it in line with other boards and commissions, and quite frankly, we look to the board to help us police our own profession, and they do a good job of it, and those people who are guilty of unprofessional conduct, you know, we don't support them, you know, regardless of whether they're members of our association or not. So we kind of cut them adrift. Senator George brought the issue up to me that he felt maybe $5,000 was excessive in a small business environment. We did not object to that, and we rolled that forward. In further discussion, he also brought up the concept that $5,000 doesn't seem to be much of a penalty for the companies that the board needs to be going after, and hence he asked that be increased to $10,000 after having gone to the APHA national meeting this last weekend in Atlanta. I have grave reason to think $10,000 is inadequate too for the size of the problems out of there, but it gives us at least a starting point. So that's where we stand. The individual practitioners in Oregon are in favor of doing whatever we can to protect the integrity of our profession. And I would also add that in our view, the purpose of the board isn't only to protect and foster the profession, it's also to protect the public. And I would like to say there are no pharmacists anywhere in Oregon who would even consider flaunting the law I know that to be untrue, so I won't put it on the record. But, you know, like any profession, there are people who are going to try to capitalize on their position. And that happens in pharmacy as well as medicine and everywhere else. So, all in all, you know, back to your question, you know, we support this, the concept. We don't see a major problem. We would be prepared to scream bloody murder if the board got out of control and started using this improperly against pharmacists, and you'd hear about it, I'm sure. But the way it stands now, we just don't have a problem.
Mr. Chair.
Hey, thank you. Here's what I would like to do, if that's okay. I'd like to get the -1 amendment adopted, and then I'd like to close the work session and ask Representative Bonamici to perhaps prepare an amendment to deal with Section 3, which might be deleting it or something else, and we'll bring it up in the full committee for further discussion.
And just as a footnote, the -1 amendment was adopted.
Oh, it's already adopted. Okay, great.
In its current form.
Okay.
So.
Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question, and I seem to recall prior testimony, Mr. Thompson, that a primary focus of this bill is to go after drug outlets.
Yes.
And that is why in the -1 amendments you came forward with the $10,000 penalty. I think what is of concern and perhaps is a higher price than even the $1,000 directed at individual pharmacists is the stripping of the due process opportunity that a regular proceeding or certainly the administrative law proceeding puts in place. And that's the concern that I have and was trying to address when we first dealt with this. And Mr. Musell was not able to be here. We did have his email testimony. But Mr. Risberger did present. I think it's serious enough, and obviously Mr. Musell does, who has 30-some years of administrative law practice, I might be overstating that we should pay attention to that.
Don't remember what I said. We wouldn't stand in the way of this. If it was found that this is administratively improper, you know, bad public policy, whatever, the greater good of the bill is to be able to go after these people. It would diminish the ability of the board to take action against those people who misuse the process. But maybe it's your decision. Maybe at that it's more important to preserve the legal atmosphere than it is to win against these individual cases. But the OSPA did not consider these additional factors in the original discussion. I did bring this subject up with Senator George. He hadn't thought about it either. So this is a whole new concept brought in on top of what we understood to be and still believe to be the original intent of the bill. I think from our position, we'd like to see this bill move forward, and if it takes some adjustment along these later lines to do it, we wouldn't oppose that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just say that it has been through the Senate. It's here in the House, and I think I'm not anxious to move this forward until this is addressed in a situation where we can perhaps come to some agreement.
Yeah.
And understanding, and once again, I heard used a few too many times the word assume. So we're in a past policy that is probably not the best policy decision to be making, and assuming we might not violate it.
Yeah. Well, if this were a bad bill, I mean, we obviously have done that in the past, where you know there have been things that had to be corrected after the fact because of unintended consequences. And if we can establish unintended consequences here, then fix it. You know. But,
okay, I will. I'm going to close the public hearing on the work session on Senate Bill 200. Since it's a Senate bill, I don't feel quite the time pressure I feel on the House bills. So, Representative Bonamici, I'd give you some time to work on this. You might check in with Ms. Clark, Ms. Thompson.
I think Representative Flores would be willing to help me with that, too.
I would love to.
There you go.
And anybody else?
We have a mini work group. And we almost closed. Well, I have 501. Close the House Committee on Health Care. And thank you all.